Good morning. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you today. And while I'm a bit out of my comfort zone, I have to confess that I initially turned down the opportunity to be here. But after I did, I kept hearing a little voice in the middle of the night telling me, you should do this. And strangely, the voice sounded a lot like the voice of Alex Duraeus, who was a professor here at BYU when I was a student. On the third floor of the A wing of this very building, I was in Brother Duraeus' senior design seminar class over 30 years ago. And I remember the final critique of our senior projects that we had been working on all semester. I had worked hard and things had turned out pretty well, but there were many things that I would like to have done better. And as the class critiqued each piece, I humbly explained what I was trying to do and what didn't work out as well as I had intended. Brother Duraeus slowly walked over to me and put his hand on my shoulder and said, Perry, you've done a good job. The appropriate response to the feedback today is thank you. Your modesty is actually a form of pride and reveals an immaturity that you will need to overcome. Well, I hope I have matured a little bit since that time. So I was stunned, but that lesson has made a big difference in my life. And so today I say thank you for the honor of being here today. You will notice that I did not entitle this presentation, How to Balance Your Life. Now, that is something I've been striving to do all my life and is a lecture for someone else to give and one that I'd very much like to attend. But maybe I can shed a little bit of light on why balance is important. I want to talk about how the creative process affects being a member of the church, or how being a member of the church affects the creative process. In 1977, President Spencer W. Kimball said, take a Da Vinci or a Michelangelo or a Shakespeare and give him a total knowledge of the plan of salvation of God and personal revelation and cleanse him, and then take a look at the statues that he will carve and the murals he will paint and the masterpieces he will produce. Take a Handel and his purposeful effort, his superb talent, his earnest desire to properly depict the story, and give him inward vision of the whole true story and revelation, and what a master you have. Now, rather than reignite that old debate that was alive, where are the Mormon Mozarts and where are the Mormon Michelangelos, that was alive when I was a student here so long ago, I simply want to point out that as we are still looking for them, it's now up to you. And here you are, preparing yourself to go out in the world in your individual creative endeavors and disciplines, getting ready to break forth and take your place in the creative process. Over the years, I've heard many speculate that the reason maybe we have not met that creative challenge as a community was due to the conformity required by active church membership, that this somehow dulled the spark of brilliance and averaged out the best of us. Think about that for a minute. Does a church whose mission it is to perfect its members actually keep us in a zone of moderation? And does balance actually mean conventional and therefore mediocre? To apply the word conform to church membership is short-sighted. Dr. Carolyn Mace observes that everyone conforms, even and maybe especially those who profess to be nonconformists and reject or consider the norms or restraints of a traditional society only to conform to a different society. They often adopt or conform to almost a stereotype, the dress, symbols, and manners of the group. You can see evidence of this in almost every city or country where goth or punk groups are almost identical, wherever you find them, as if there was a guidebook or a rule book. And she states that everyone needs to belong to somewhere and that people simply select a tribe. And every tribe has rituals and rites of passage. She theorizes that the piercings and tattoos of young people today are attempts to fill the spiritual voids that are innate in all of us, and that they have rejected in traditional society. If the spiritual connection cannot be made in one society, we will attempt to fulfill it with another. In our quest to find our place in the vast universe and connect with others where we would otherwise be very much alone. And surprisingly, this is illustrated in a book written by my former agency partner, Douglas Atkin, called The Culting of Brands. And in it, he shows the positive power of social community that energizes membership through integration and shared ideas. Instead of brainwashed automatons that we think of so often, powerlessly submitting to some intangible controlling force, he defines brand cult followers as highly selective, voluntary contributors in the most positive of ways. He even includes the church as a case study in his book, among other famous brands such as Harley-Davidson, Apple, and JetBlue. And all these brands can be defined as cults by having these and other strong attributes in common. a strong and charismatic founder, a unifying symbol or logo, evangelistic and devoted followers, and even proprietary language and culture. In this book, he states, and I quote, "The common belief is that people join cults to conform. Actually, the very opposite is true. They join to become more individual. As one cult member unequivocally put it, belonging allows the individual to become more himself. You become more you," end quote. But I think Elder James E. Faust said it best when he said, "Within our spiritual unity, there is wide room for everyone's individuality and expression. Still, there are some who may use responsibilities to church and family to excuse themselves from taking place on the world stage, or excuse themselves from family and church in order to seek the spotlight. But don't we who hold fast to our responsibilities also have the responsibility to lead and contribute among the very best? I have noticed for many years that those who are truly world-class in any field, artistic or otherwise, seem to be truly eccentric. Some endearingly so, others alarmingly. It is not an easy sphere to occupy, even if you have the talent to qualify. But there are also those who are leaders in their fields because of the stabilizing influence of heaven and home. Finding a balance is difficult. Let's admit that walking along the tightrope of serving God, family, and our creative talent is not easy. While working in New York City and commuting 2 hours each way every day, time became so precious. I would try to use my commute time to best advantage, using one way for personal things like scripture reading, meditation, prayer, reading the newspaper, or a quick nap. And the return trip was used for finishing things in my train file. Anything that could be done on the train instead of at the desk was prepared by my assistant with the goal to leave the job behind when I walked in the door at home. Many nights, the file was filled with more than the 2-hour commute could complete. And Saturdays were crammed with household and yard chores, kids' lessons, sports activities, and various errands and projects. Sundays were dawn-to-dusk meetings and church work. I would rise early morning, tired, and head to the train and do it all over again, finding colleagues at the office bouncing in, fresh and revitalized, from a Sunday of golf and barbecuing with friends. Early one Monday morning, as I passed through Grand Central after getting off the train, I bumped into a friend I had worked with at Ogilvy. He was a creative director who was several years ahead of me in the business and was now at another agency. I asked him how things were going. He replied, "Things are great. I'm sailing every weekend, and I'm even working on that book I've always wanted to write." And then I asked, "How are things at work?" "Well," he said, "things are great. I'm sailing every weekend, and I'm working on that book I've always wanted to write." And shrugged his shoulders. Oh. I did not know whether to pity him or envy him, and I thought about it for weeks. I wondered if I could be satisfied working for the weekends that it afforded me, but not finding fulfillment in my creative pursuit each day. On the other hand, would I be willing to pay the price demanded of me to be truly outstanding professionally? I looked around for heroes and examples. It was almost impossible to find someone to look up to in the creative departments of the New York advertising world. I'm sure they must have existed, but those I admired creatively were often coping through heavy substance abuse and were on their second or third, or more often between marriage, or more often between relationships or married to their work. And those who I admired personally seemed content to be doing a job that I felt would not be professionally satisfying or challenging. I felt disheartened by the apparent choice before me and resolved not to be beaten by an industry that burns out its best and its brightest. So when you are ready to leave this nurturing place of development, I want you to be ready and prepared for what you will find, and some of my experiences may spare you of the same lessons. First, you will find that not everyone will admire or support your values. When I was naive when I discovered that not only did some people, probably most people I was working with, did not even aspire to maintain the same values I was working so hard for, but in fact actually found them annoying and a source of irritation. Instead of encouraging acknowledgement you want when you leave a bit early to make sure you make it to that parent-teacher conference or your daughter's recital or your son's football game, you will soon learn that those you leave behind can be resentful. And next you will find that you will work in a world of tough choices and daily balancing act of decisions that are not clearly black and white. You will find yourself asking many times each day, which is the most right, or which is the least wrong thing to do? Sometimes the responsible thing is to leave right now, or you will miss that important family event, while other times the right thing to do is stay in the office with the rest of the team and work all night for the big meeting the next day. In the book, The Mormon Way of Doing Business, Gary Crittenden tells about how when he was both the state president and the CFO of American Express, when it was annual budget time at work, he was not a very good state president. And when he was preparing for a youth conference, for example, he spent many more hours on church work than he did as the chief financial officer at work. He also found a way to balance personal life with the demands of his profession by hiring a driver for his 90-minute commute each morning and evening so he could spend that time talking to his family through personal phone calls and emails. Many years ago, I was at a children's literature conference, and I asked a famous author how she managed to produce so many popular books and still managed to be the wife and mother of a busy family. She replied to me that one day it dawned on her that while it was her responsibility to provide a freshly ironed shirt for her husband each day, her hardworking husband, she did not have to personally iron that shirt. She said, writing gives me the opportunity to pay someone to iron a shirt while I do what I love. Okay, that was decades ago, and I can almost hear you thinking, who irons shirts anymore, or can't he take his own shirts to the laundry? And things have changed a little bit since then, but the principle is the same. And in our pioneering do-it-yourself culture, I know how guilty you can feel, thinking you need to change your own oil and mow your own lawn. But understand that even if you like doing those things, there will always be the choices and trade-offs. If you're going to be really successful, you will have to balance those choices. Sometimes our lives are so busy finding balance that we find it by rather extreme measures, trying to make up for lost time or reset the balance. For tax purposes, one year, it was necessary to tally the number of days that I had worked out of the office in New York City in traveling for work. I was shocked to find that I had spent more time traveling than at home, 187 days. Of course, my wife was not at all surprised. And once, after a month of television commercial production in Los Angeles turned into 5 and then 6 weeks straight, she had had enough. I was missing my family very much and feeling sorry for myself, stuck in long hours of revisions in dark editing rooms under intense pressure. I called home for solace and sympathy, and I got a reality check instead. Ogilvy was kind enough to offer me a consolation. A week-long cruise with my little family on the big red boat to the Bahamas. It was great fun to spend a full week with the family 24/7, snorkeling, swimming, shuffleboarding, and gorging at the buffet. But I knew that this was an extreme sort of balance that was unsustainable and an unhealthy alternative. So I started an agency with the idea that being my own boss was a means to get control over my life. In some ways it was true, but in many more, it was not, as anyone who has ever had their own business can tell you. But that did not keep us from trying. Balance was a central governing factor as we founded the agency, both with the people we hired and the clients we worked for. David Ogilvy said, clients get the advertising they deserve. And that is not so much a blame of the client, but an acknowledgement of the partnership in the creative process. A good marketing director must have both vision and power. If a marketing director has clout but no vision, the work is disappointing and compromised. If a marketing director has vision but no clout, then you spin your wheels, getting nowhere. And when it comes to producing that work, another kind of balance becomes important. Work that is strategic but not creative is dull. Work that is creative but not strategic is indulgent. Only work that is on strategy and is creative is truly effective. And so after more than a dozen years as balancer-in-chief, when the opportunity came to retire from the agency business in 2002, we left the fast track for a few peaceful green acres on a farm in central Virginia. And we put the quote up in the kitchen from Brigham Young as the governing theme of our new life. It says, life is best enjoyed when periods are evenly divided between labor, sleep, and recreation. A formula for balance from a wise and successful man. It is so simple and plain that I wondered why I could not think of anybody who was applying that formula. I had just left a world that worked too much, and I knew many people who slept too much, and even a few who spent the majority of their time in pursuit of recreation. But we knew we could do it. And it was only last month, however, after 7 years of trying, when I was circling one of our fields in the long rows on the mower in the evening as the light began to fade, I realized I had traded one form of imbalance for another. After I mow past the empty hammock that I received for Father's Day a few years ago, in which I have probably logged in about 45 minutes total, I climbed the stairs to my new studio where I was going to learn to oil paint, and turn my back on the shiny new easel in the corner with the half-price sale tag still on it, and I take out my calculator, pay a few bills, and make some calls for church. How did this happen? It is common for us that when we overcome one challenge or addictive behavior, to replace it with another. We do what is comfortable, and we respond to what is urgent. I decided it would be necessary for me to do a full year's worth of very bad paintings in order to overcome the fear of that blank white canvas that sits in the corner, untouched on the easel. I thought it came to Virginia fearless and ready to learn, and in some ways I have. I can change the oil on my John Deere tractor. And I raised goats and chickens for the first time. But these grew to fill up all the time, pleasurable as they were, as essentials that demand attention, and in expense of the things that I wanted to do, but somehow felt were indulgent, waiting until all the responsibility things were checked off before I could allow myself to just go out and create something. So I offer this confession, lest you think of me as a hypocrite, that I'm still a work of progress, waiting for permission or perhaps the assignment to go out and do something great. I take inspiration and courage from a line in Chekhov's letters. You must once and for all give up being worried about success and failure. Don't let that concern you. It's your duty to go on working steadily, day by day, quite quietly, to be prepared for mistakes, which are inevitable, and for failures. The ancient philosophy of yin and yang is about balance. The symbol of yin and yang are tear-shaped halves contained into a whole in a dynamic exchange. They are not just opposites, they are complements. One depends on the other. These dualities of yin and yang represent male, female, cold, hot, light and dark, and other things in constant interaction. And it is a fascinating philosophy that has been integral to ancient cultures for thousands of years, yet it seems to be hidden from the Western world. But don't worry, it is not a religion and will therefore not interfere with your Mormon beliefs. Rather, as with all truth, it is compatible with them. I share it only because it illustrates that there are forces at work all around you, whether you are aware of them or not. Take food, for example. Yin and yang is the framework for a macrobiotic diet that some use as an alternative natural way to promote healing. And instead of food being considered simply for proteins, fats, and carbohydrates, or even calories, vitamins, fiber, and taste, it is considered in many other ways as well. Yin and yang properties are considered for each food. Whether a food is acid or alkaline, expansive or contractive, whether it grows in the ground, on the ground, or above the ground, and is considered as well as where it grows geographically and in what season. But that's not all. What color it is and how it is prepared by chopping, slicing, mashing, boiling, frying, steaming, sautéing, or baking seems to matter too. And I won't even mention the effects are compounded by the way foods are combined. And all this is done with the understanding that everything that enters the body will benefit it, harm it, or pass through inertly as neutral. The idea is to increase specific benefits while minimizing or eliminating anything harmful. I think you could say the same thing about our thoughts and our decisions. Everything we do affects us in some way, large or small, and we are the result of the sum of our decisions. If you are what you eat, then it is also true that you are what you think. On the yin and yang food scale, the most yin foods like sugar and ice cream are at one end of the spectrum, and the most yang foods like red meat are at the other. Balancing foods with centering properties like brown rice and probably broccoli are smack dab in the middle. So no wonder being balanced can often be thought of as dull, drab, or uninteresting. Our food choices often lead us to more exciting, indulgent things that are found at the far ends of the spectrum. And yet, oddly, the great American meal of a chocolate shake and a cheeseburger actually form a radical kind of balance, although not a long-term or healthy one. It seems that the forces of the universe are always trying to bring things into balance, and as yin and yang continually interact, they can dominate and displace each other for a time, but they can never be more than the whole. While there seems to be a self-correcting mechanism in place that is triggered when something is pushed past the point of extreme. And when something does pass that point of extreme, it will often turn into its opposite. It took me a while to understand this principle, but picture a balloon. As it is inflated, it grows to its maximum size. Continue to inflate it, and it will explode and return back to its original flaccid condition. A sapling grows to be a mighty tree until it reaches its maximum potential, and then it dies and breaks apart, returning once again back to the earth. This can also be applied to extreme human behavior, such as the fanatic who, in his zealous cause, will bomb an abortion clinic, killing and maiming in the name of saving lives. In our lives, when we reach the extremes, we burn out and crash. We live in a material world where too often, too much is never enough. But in the spare world of less is more, there can also be imbalance. I think of the tragic beauty of the Shakers. Their buildings, furniture, and household objects are elegant evidence that when form follows function, real and lasting beauty is created. But this short-lived community also offered evidence that taking everything to the extreme can lead to extinction. The society became eccentric. It lost its balance. By seeking a higher road to perfection, it separated men and women, even married couples, through a strict policy of celibacy. The sect could only grow through converts and adoption of orphans. And from a maximum group of 6,000 members in 1840, in 2008, there were only 8 members remaining. In that classic fireside address by Elder Dallin H. Oakes in 2005, and I think you know the one, dating versus hanging out. But I want to reference the part quoted where he quoted Governor Adlai E. Stevenson on patriotism and applied it to the gospel. It can also be applied to the creative process, and I quote, "What we need is not short, frenzied outbursts of emotion, but the tranquil, steady dedication of a lifetime," end quote. He also quoted a teacher he had here at BYU who gave this definition of a fanatic. A fanatic is one who has lost sight of his goal but has redoubled his effort to get there. And he said that this has been a good guide throughout his life, adding, and quote, "Don't seek to prove your dedication by fanatical excesses or by other evidence of holier than thou. We pay tithing, but remember that tithing is a steady 10%, not 8%, and especially not an intermittent or frenzied outburst of 12%, end quote. I learned the hard way that steady service has more value than extreme behavior. While training my new missionary in the north of England, we decided to be the very best that we could be and asked the Lord to shower us with blessings and success. We would not return home without knocking on just one more door and giving out that last Book of Mormon. And if fasting one day for our investigators was good, then fasting 2 days was twice as good. And we were serious about our work and tried not to waste a minute, from rising earlier than was required and sailing home in the rain on our bicycles just in time for lights out. Like the balloon that blown up to bursting that I mentioned earlier, our zealous missionary work resulted not in an outpouring of success, but instead a week and a half lost in bed with flu and fever. Obedience is better than sacrifice, counseled the mission president with both love and chastisement. I worked with a talented young photographer in Salt Lake City many years ago who would not take his medications because it dulled his energy and made him foggy. Instead, he thrived on the manic high of working around the clock in creative bursts of brilliance until he would collapse in fatigue, his body short-circuiting and demanding payback for the will of the spirit overriding the limits of the flesh. He felt that he could not be the artist he was meant to be under the tempering influence of his prescription drugs. He was successful in his craft, but it cost him his wife and his family. There have been many one-hit wonders out there who surely intended to be a long-time stars, but it is difficult to sustain when you live in the extreme. You may burn brighter and hotter for a while, but not for long. Balance can keep you alive and productive for a very long time. I know a talented cellist who practiced between 4 and 7 hours every day while in high school and was therefore considered inactive, as she did not often participate in young women meetings or activities. Was this dedication or eccentric behavior? It is not surprising that there are not many Mormon movie stars and celebrities. Surely it demands an eccentric lifestyle. And I was amused to read a couple of cover interviews from 2 popular stars where the point was made by one interviewer that one was raised Mormon and the other used to be a practicing Mormon, as if leaving the constraining shackles of the church membership somehow launched their rocket of celebrity and achievement. Well, perhaps it did. On the other hand, it was pointed out to me by a Mormon hipster that the lead singer for The Killers, Brandon Flowers, and his wife came back to the church after the birth of their first child. So the universe is ever changing and your world is never going to stay the same for very long. Even if you keep trying, the forces beyond your control will make that impossible. But there are constants that can anchor you as you go forward on your journey. Remember that as you strive to live your values. And you will find that while some things may be legal, they are not necessarily moral. You will also find that those whose values are negotiable or relative will clearly feel judged by those whose values are non-negotiable or absolute. And you will find in large and small ways, wherever you go or work, that many will not share your values. I was taught that the right thing to do is always the right thing to do. What I had to learn was that the right thing is different to different people. While working as design director at Macy's headquarters in New York, I was surprised to be called into my boss's office one day. I knew I'd been doing a pretty good job and was anticipating a good meeting. But when he told me to close the door in a sober tone, I knew something was wrong. He started yelling and was so angry that he actually threw a book across the room at me. He missed. And he told me that if I was going to be so honest, that I would never go anywhere in this company. Excuse me? What had I done? And he angrily explained that I had embarrassed him and the whole department by talking to another department about why we had been late on a project. Unwittingly, I had explained to another manager the honest and understandable circumstances instead of offering up the departmental lie of blame that would absolve us from responsibility. There was no defending myself. Even though I did not know what I was officially supposed to have said, I should have at least made something up or said nothing, anything but the truth. I left his office knowing that I had a choice to make, that building a future there meant not just doing a good job creatively, but becoming politically astute at damage control and manipulation. I went home and told Carolyn that it was time to look for another job. I prayed about what to do, as I had been so grateful to have a good job after a long period of financial struggle. But within 2 weeks, I got a call from out of the blue. It was from Estee Lauder Human Resources Department, who said that for some reason they had kept my resume from over a year ago and wanted to see if I could come in for an interview. Well, this surprised me, as I had never knowingly applied to Estee Lauder, nor would have. But apparently, it was from my response to an ad for a design position at an unnamed company some 18 months before, when I had also applied at Macy's and others. I got the job, and with better pay and more benefits. I also got called as the bishop of our New Jersey ward. I started my new job trying to distinguish myself in a very competitive environment and to do the Lord's work as shepherd of a little flock in the suburbs of New Jersey. And it seemed that while I came to the office each morning on time, I was the last to arrive. And I felt guilty as I tried to slip out unnoticed at 5 or 6 p.m. to commute home two or three evenings during the week so I could for the interviews and meetings that awaited me at the church while everyone else was busy back in their offices. I was sure that one day that behavior would soon result in something similar to the Macy's experience. As I boarded the bus on those nights, thinking about the unfinished work I had left back in my office desk, I told the Lord that I would help him do his work if he would help me do mine. And I want to tell you that he kept his part of the agreement. Often the answers to a difficult or lingering problem came to me as I shaved or showered on the very day those answers were needed. I felt an acceleration of my talents both in church and temporal affairs. It took a long time for it to dawn on me that the Lord had not really accepted my offer to be his partner, but instead I had accepted that long-standing offer that he has given to all of us in Matthew 6:33. But seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all things shall be added unto you. Therefore, take therefore no thought for the morrow will take thought for the things of itself. When it was time for annual interviews, Carol, a talented and dedicated designer, returned in tears and passing my office and told me it was my turn. Carol had the office next to mine and was in early and stayed late each day and was always there for some part of the weekend. I made that long walk down to the corner office with a knot in my stomach. I was given a raise and a small bonus and told that it was evident that I was able to resolve my project successfully in less time than my coworkers seemed to require. And I relate this to give you the confidence to rely on your partnership with the Lord. It is true what Madeleine L'Engle said in her book, Walking on Water. An artist is a nourisher and a creator who knows that during the act of creation there is collaboration. We do not create alone. And what better partner could you have than the creator of all things? But I learned something else while working at Estee Lauder. Trust your intuition. It is part of your gift. I had enjoyed early success at Estee Lauder, launching the first ever Lauder for Men lines of products. So I was put in charge of developing a new women's fragrance, the first in a very long time. Mr. Lauder had died, and Mrs. Lauder had spent over a year away out of the office and out of the public eye. But she was ready to come back, and a new fragrance launch would revitalize the Lauder brand. Her fragrance was selected, and a bottle was designed. Only a name, a carton, and a product positioning remained. The launch team met each week for months. Piles of competitive sales reports were analyzed. If a competitor's product was doing well, it was determined that we also needed something bold and graphic. Or the next week, we need something soft and subtle. We were floundering, had the nose, as Mrs. Lauder was called. Lost her touch after all these years? This is not how she's built her business. In the 1950s, a little housewife from Queens named Esther followed a hunch that American women would like to buy a perfume bath oil that she had developed with the clever name of Youth Dew. And she was right. So she changed her name to Estée, including a European accent over the second E, and with an enhanced Austrian heritage and a few family secret recipes, she launched what became a multi-billion dollar international beauty business. Months later, after I had personally designed over 100 cartons, and some of them were beautiful, they were really outstanding, I think, and over 500 names had been considered and researched, it came down to two names and two carton designs. The national sales meeting was just days away, and Mrs. Lauder had still not made the final decision. The night before the sales meeting where the product was to be introduced, Mrs. Lauder walked in and with a dramatic gesture swept the cartons off the table, pointed a manicured finger and pronounced, "We're calling it beautiful. The carton will be a bright pink version of the new Lauder for men, and the advertising will feature a bride." And she left the room. Well, we all just about gagged. And so I set about cutting and pasting pink cartons late into the night while the advertising team ran off in search of all things wedding and bridal. Beautiful was not one of the names that had been researched or tested. Mrs. Lauder, the Blue Lady, was radically departing from her signature color, and a bride theme was risky and limiting. But you know what? Beautiful was a runaway bestseller and remains strong so today. After all the research and analysis, nothing will beat intuition. And as you continue to try and achieve a balance of faith and works, you will find that having a spouse and family and a calling in the church will make it so that it is not possible for you to be eccentric or extreme. My wife and I learned this together just after we were married. She told me that I could stand to put a little more elbow grease behind my faith. And I in turn told her that if she had a little more faith, she wouldn't have to work quite so hard. Our opposite natures are the dynamic complements of yin and yang. Balance makes consistency possible, and consistency increases value. Being consistent in performance and in the application of your values will increase your value, even if it may seem to cost you at times. When I started the advertising agency with two partners in New York City, it was understood that I would not want any alcohol or tobacco accounts at an agency with my name on the door. That was not a problem for a while. Until one day, feeling rumblings and pressure from within the ranks, one of my partners, a brilliant and dynamic woman, came to me trying to convince me that the creative and monetary opportunities that were offered were so attractive that we should accept an invitation to pitch a popular beer account. "It doesn't seem fair," she said to me carefully, "to impose your morals on the rest of the agency." I was unprepared for this, as it had not been an issue for our first few years of success together. And finally, I responded that we had founded an agency that put the interests of our clients first, with a promise that we would do all within our power as their agency partners to build their business as if it were our own. I told her that I don't care enough about their product and therefore its success to fulfill that promise. She quickly agreed, apologized, and left my office. Now, just to keep things balanced, I want to remind you that you will not be the only one out there with strong morals and values. My other partner was a man of such integrity and principle that it was astounding to know that he lived and worked the way he did with no thought of doing so to be able to get a temple recommend. There are a great many people out there who have a voluntary internal code of ethics that we could all learn from. And being smug or having an attitude of moral superiority is not attractive and is an extreme that will set you off balance. Let's see if you can identify this famous athlete who said this about balance. "My life is a circus," he says, so he keeps his commitments remarkably simple. Family and football are at the top of the list, of course, and next are his endorsement responsibilities and charity work. And after that, well, that's about it. People always ask me, "Do you play golf?" I used to play golf, but to be honest, I'd rather spend 4 hours with the kids than on the golf course. You were probably thinking of a Mormon, weren't you? But it may surprise you that David Beckham sounds like a Mormon in the way he focuses his balance, the way he's found to balance the extremes demanded on him by his profession. And while family is the framework for balancing one world-class achiever, a commitment to God is the way for another. Musician Lenny Kravitz shocked many after the extreme lifestyle of most rock stars when he made a personal vow of celibacy. After being linked with a long line of beautiful women, he woke up one day and said, "What am I doing?" Most people cannot believe that he is saving himself for marriage, but he says, quote, "I'm 3 years into it, and it just becomes what it is. It frees you from a lot of things, and it also takes a lot of power away from the people who are trying to seduce you. So it's an interesting journey. Ultimately, I'm trying to do the right thing and trying to honor myself and the other person and honor God. End quote. It is ironic that it is Kravitz's behavior that is seen as eccentric by those in the industry in which he works. I know Madeline Lengel, I quote Madeline Lengel again, the artist is a Christian like any other Christian. The artist who is a Christian like any other Christian is required to be in this world but not of it. We are to be in this world as healers and as listeners and as servants. We all know how difficult it is to be to live and work in this world. I used to envy Adam and Eve at peace in the Garden of Eden until I realized that the only real job I could determine that they had to do was to name all the animals. But without weeds to pull or cat fights to break up or lambs to rescue from the lions, it was probably not all that interesting. And so now as we work by the sweat of our brow, life is always interesting and full of challenges every day. As you are cast out of this place and into the real world, hold on to those values and live them, especially in the arts, where in the name of enlightenment, there are few limits or restraints, except, ironically, on Christian morals and virtues. You will be thrown off balance as you work and live among friends and enemies of the faith. Balance is important, but it is not the end. It is the means to an end. I am just starting to understand that balance is not the goal, but the means of reaching the real goals, those that elude you, when you have lost your balance and it gives way to eccentric behavior and a lopsided life. It is a waste of your time in this world to pray that you have no problems. Rather, pray that there is a solution to every problem. Remember, if God created a world with no pain, no problems, no grief, it would be a world of no choices. I love this quote and will end by giving George Bernard Shaw the last word. This is the true joy in life, to be used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one, to be thoroughly worn out before you are thrown on the scrap heap, to be a force of nature instead of a feverish little clod of ailments and grievances complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. I am a member of a community, and as a member, it is my privilege to do for it whatever I can before I die. Life is no brief candle to me. It is a sort of splendid torch that I want to make burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations. Thank you very much.